Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, May 29th, 2025, and our friend Graham Fuller is back with us. Welcome back, Graham.
Thank you very much, Nima. My pleasure.
Graham, one of the main issues with the foreign policy of the United States is the situation in the Middle East, in Gaza, between Israel and Palestine. But when you zoom out from the region and you see the ongoing talks between Iran and the United States and the way that Netanyahu and his administration are somehow they're talking about if they get something from these talks, we're going to attack. If they don't get, we're going to attack. It doesn't seem that the improvement in the relationship between the United States and Iran is any... they're not considering as a positive thing for Israel. Why is that the case? Why Israel feels that they can, the only war with Iran would benefit them, which we know that would be devastating for Israel?
Well, obviously, there are several reasons why Israel likes to make Iran the enemy. First of all, Iran is certainly the biggest and most important country in the region, geopolitically speaking, perhaps only rivaled by Turkey, which has a slightly more modest role, but also a powerful player. But secondly, as you know, the fact that Iran is the only other potentially nuclear state in the region threatens Israeli absolute domination in the nuclear sphere and would be considered unacceptable. So those are two very good reasons, and Israel wants to have dominance in the region, and Iran is better placed than most other states to make that very difficult for Israel to achieve.
And when it comes to the way that Donald Trump is dealing with Netanyahu, do you think that Netanyahu, without a permission from the United States, would attack Iran or would risk a direct conflict with Iran?
I do not think that Bibi will attack Iran, either with America. Certainly, I doubt that the United States or Trump will give him permission to do so. And secondly, I don't think that he would do it without full backing of the United States. Israel has a lot of power, and short of nuclear war, that war is going to be very costly and damaging, and also damaging to United States' interests in the region. Iran will be able to strike with its missiles many U.S. military bases in the region, cause great anxiety and division within the region. So obviously the United States feels it will not benefit from that kind of a approach to dealing with Iran. On top of that, Trump, as he said, he philosophically is very different. He doesn't see why countries have to be permanent enemies. That's an important consideration. Why do countries have to be permanent enemies? I think he sees that it is not in U.S. interest to have an enemy in Iran if we can possibly avoid it. So that's good.
Graham, do you see the potential in the Middle East? Do you see the changes that are happening in the Middle East to be considered in the United States, at least by the Trump administration? Because when we look at the case of Israel, whenever it comes to Israel, the United States has to pay everything. Weapons, money, everything to Israel. But when Donald Trump goes to the Arab states, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, it's just receiving everything. It's not just about giving, but receiving. I'm not arguing that they're just investing in the United States just for the sake of investment, because they know how important the United States is in the Middle East. That's why they're behaving this way. But when it comes to Iran, it's been more than 40 years of the conflict between the United States and Iran in the aftermath of the revolution in Iran. I think there is nothing there to build on this sort of animosity anymore. Why do they not consider some sort of political moves that may change the face of the Middle East, that may benefit everybody in the Middle East? Because these old policies are so much consumed, are so much old that they're not working. Everybody knows that they're not working. I think that's one of the reasons that these Arab states are changing their mind in that region.
Yes. We talked before, Nima, about the very important role that China played in helping broker a more peaceful relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iran. That was quite a stunning development, and many specialists in the region might have said it could never happen because we all know that Sunnis hate Shia and Shia hate Sunnis. But there's no reason to necessarily accept that. I also maybe once before mentioned the very interesting and important former foreign minister of Turkey, maybe 20 years ago, a man named Ahmet Davutoğlu, who came up with what was at that time a very startling idea when he announced that Turkey was changing its policies into what he called zero enemies policy. Turkey had bad relations with every single one of its neighbors for a long, long period of time, partly as a member of NATO, partly because the U.S. encouraged Turkey to be negative to Eastern Europe or Soviet Union or whatever else. Davutoğlu basically said, we don't have to have enemies and we can decide not to have enemies. And overnight, Turkey improved its opened relations with all of its neighbors, just about all of them, traditional enemies like Greece. So this was a very important idea that you don't have to have enemies. But the United States has always preferred having enemies because it's one of its main instruments and tools of forcing other countries into allegiance or alignment or foreign blocks against other countries. It likes to have enemies so that you can then sell weapons to people to use against those enemies. So this is a very radical idea of no enemies, and I hope I'm interested to see the hints of this idea now and what Trump has been saying lately, that we don't have to have them. Yet, as you know, the neocons, neoconservatives in Washington have always bought into the idea of permanent enemies.
And you mentioned Turkey, Graham. Do you think that Turkey, that the foreign minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, if I'm not mistaken, his name was, he was somehow pursuing this sort of, did they achieve something pursuing that sort of strategy, or they're not getting there because of the region, because of the complexity of the region? Because when you talk about Turkey itself, it's not just about Turkey, it's about the mindset of the people around you. Let's get back to the mindset of human being. It's this sort of otherizing people, otherizing societies, countries is somehow historic. It's in our DNA. We have to overcome that. But somehow it's not just about me. It's about how the other countries are seeing me as a country.
Yeah. Excuse me. I think that Turkey's policies were quite successful during Davutoğlu's period in office. There was no particular failure, but I think after he departed, other events took place in the region. But Turkey never went back to its traditional hostility with virtually all neighbors, and that was driven mainly by NATO perceptions. The United States wanted Turkey to adopt NATO's enemies and support NATO against all of those enemies. Well, Certainly, Turkey has gone well beyond that now. Turkey essentially, as you know, is technically a member of NATO and finds advantages in remaining technically a member. But its policies have gone far, far beyond that in directions that NATO finds very upsetting. Turkey now considers itself dealing in all over the Mediterranean and Northern Africa and in the Middle East, in the Muslim world, even in Central Asia, Turkish world, all of that kind of thing. So Turkey has permanently changed as a result of that shift in ideology. I hope that other countries might consider that as well, to realize that to have enemies is in many cases a choice. I don't want to say in every case, but I think if you look at it, people generally choose to have enemies because they want to have war or they want to build a big military or any number of reasons. But it's part of a revolution in thinking about foreign policy. We also see a little hints of this in Chinese foreign policy with the use of this term win-win that China has talked about. I don't think China invented this term. It's an old thing, win-win or lose-lose. But China has applied this concept very seriously to its foreign relations and likes to talk about how they can have a win-win relationship with everybody. Doesn't mean everybody gets what they all want, but it means that both come out better than when they were in some kind of relationship of hostility or confrontation.
Yeah, it's been such a long time that the United States didn't consider any sort of strategy that somehow sees win-win. But that's why we have zero-sum game in the foreign policy of the United States. But do you think that it's changing under the Trump administration, or the United States foreign policy is getting to the point that they have to compete instead of being dominant? That's why they're changing their mindset.
That's a very profound question, Nima, and I can't give you any one simple answer to that. First of all, Trump does not like neoconservatives. There was an article that recently appeared written by in the magazine called The American Conservative that is not neoconservative. And let me just quickly set forth what to your readers, what the difference is here. I mean, conservatives or whatever. Conservatives traditionally have valued family and religion and stability and peace where possible, and national pride. Neoconservatives come out of a Russian revolutionary tradition that basically was seeking global revolution. There was a guy named Leon Trotsky, who was a rival to Joseph Stalin, as to whether Russia's policies should be building socialism, communism in one country, as Stalin argued, or Trotsky argued, no, we want revolution everywhere, all over the world, simultaneously. And that group ultimately became what became known as neoconservatism in the United States. It's fundamentally revolutionary, overthrowing regimes, changing the world in the image that you want it to be. So there's a fundamental contradiction here between traditional conservatism and neoconservatism. I think neoconservatism by now has proven itself to be a drastic failure in American foreign policy over the years. I mean, as we know, America has been at nonstop war fundamentally since the end of the Cold War period, and engaged in wars, most of which it lost in one degree or another. They were not able to achieve their military goals. So Trump, and I think, I don't know who his advisors are in this respect, but I think they're thinking over rather carefully this idea of, does America want a policy of revolution and overthrowing enemies that we don't like? When Trump spoke in Riyadh, he made the very interesting remark. He said, He said, it's not my job to judge other countries. He said, that's God's job. That's a remarkable statement when you consider it, because no neocon, no neoconservative would ever have said that. They would have said that it is America's role to judge the value and human rights and women's rights and all these other issues. America has the right and the obligation to impose its values on other countries by revolution or even war if necessary. So you can see an incredible distinction, difference between these two perspectives. So I think Trump is, you don't have to be too brilliant to understand that American endless wars under neoconservatives have been a failure. And I think also Trump at this point is beginning to realize that although he says he loves Israel and all of that, as John Mearsheimer has pointed out for a long time, Israel is not really an ally of the United States. It's an albatross. It's a burden around America's neck. Israel's wars end up being America's wars in undesirable ways. So I have this sneaking feeling, and I've maybe mentioned this to you before, but if I were Bibi, I would be quite nervous about who Donald Trump is and where he's going. He says the right words, but in the end, he is increasingly doing things that I don't think Israel wants or likes or has any control over. And that, especially say in opening relations with Iran, the discussions with Iran or other such issues. So all of these factors, I think, coming together are beginning to change American policies, and especially if you consider that the Israel's genocidal war in Gaza has put America firmly on the side of Israel, to the horror and anger of so much of the rest of the world. And that is costing America quite dearly as well. So I think Trump may be reconsidering a little bit just how close he wants to be and how much of a winning card this is. The reason many point out that the reason for the strong ties with Israel in part are because of massive Israeli and pro-Israeli donations to American institutions, including every single congressman in Congress. So if I were Trump, I would be a little bit nervous about, am I the boss? Am I running the country? Am I in charge of Congress? I think I mentioned to you last time that there's new MAGA hats now, MAGA, that say Miriam Adelson governs America. If I were Trump, that would anger me. I'm the one who's governing America, not Miriam Adelson. Just because she gives me money doesn't mean I'm going to do what she tells me to do. So you can see there are a lot of things I think may be coming together here that may cause Trump to deal a little differently with the world than he has in past years.
Graham, we know that Benjamin Netanyahu himself is in a very desperate situation, and right now his position is at risk, and he, because of the continuous war on the part of Israel, he continues in his position. Whenever the war is over, that would hugely influence his position in Israel. That's why this makes the situation with Israel and Netanyahu much more dangerous, because a man who's desperate for anything, he's prepared to make a new gamble, the ultimate gamble against Iran. That's why, in my opinion, it would be so much dangerous. It would be so much important to consider any sort of move on his part and his administration when it comes to Donald Trump and even Iran, when they're thinking of Israel. And do you see Benjamin Netanyahu, because he has been in power for many years, and he is so smart when it comes to manipulation, to playing a game with the United States, but he's going to be that much out of touch to go with a direct conflict. It's in my opinion, that would be a suicide on his part. But I don't know if he would take such a great risk to attack Iran.
Well, you asked me earlier on, Nima, if I thought that Netanyahu would go ahead and start a war with Iran, attack Iran, without American 100% backing. I said I did not think he would do that. But I share your concern that if this man, who is a radical in many respects, who thinks only about himself, and is in a very difficult political situation, I would not utterly rule that kind of extremely irrational and dangerous and ultimately suicidal move by him. I cannot rule that out, as I think you cannot either. That's what we need. What's not what we need to worry about. It would be very interesting to know what Trump is saying to Bibi, if anything, about this issue. But I don't think there should be much doubt on the part of Netanyahu that the U.S. does not favor a military confrontation with Iran.
Graham, I think the fight on the part of Donald Trump, the bigger fight with the case of Donald Trump and his administration is not in Ukraine, is not in the Middle East, is much more within the United States, much more what's going on in the United States. You've mentioned neocons in the United States. And I know, I heard Noam Chomsky talking about he's considering himself as a classical neoliberal. And he said that was the end of neoliberal. Sorry for saying that. It was he considered himself as neoliberal, but classical one. Is not, and he said neoliberalism is somehow close to neocons, close to the mindset of neocons. Do you think these two movements in the United States are they getting together? Are they close to each other? Are they, can we call them as with the same name, these two movements? What do they want? Do they have same sort of objectives with the foreign policy of the United States?
That's a very good question, Nima, and I can't give you a really very good answer about that. First of all, I'm not sure what Noam Chomsky, for whom I have huge respect, a true prophet, like an Old Testament prophet, he even looks like an Old Testament prophet with his beard. I have tremendous respect for him, but I'm not sure what he quite means by neoliberal. So I can't really answer your question very well, except that I think one of the hallmarks of neoconservatism, as I just mentioned a few minutes ago, has been to use violence and to change the world forcefully in a revolutionary way, if you will, to bring about results that you wish to see in other countries. That is sort of what I thought neoliberals were as well, but you don't hear that word neoliberal used very much anymore in the American context. But to me, the entire difference is, do we have a right and an obligation to intervene incessantly in other countries' foreign policies or even domestic policies in the interests of some ideal or American's supposed self-interest? I think that is the big thing that distinguishes them, and where many traditional conservatives would have said, like I think you maybe heard of the Quincy Institute in Washington, and John Quincy, president of U.S. back several centuries ago, said, as president, he said, America should not go abroad in search of demons to slay or enemies to kill. That's a very profound statement, basically saying don't go overseas looking for wars for people to kill and revolutions to make. So that is the maybe more traditionally conservative view of it's not smart to do that, to do that kind of thing. It's interesting, I might point out, I don't want to suggest that it's all racial, but a great deal of the neoconservatives tend to come out of a Russian and Jewish tradition. Leon Trotsky was Jewish. There were many Russian revolutionaries who were Jewish and believed in revolution around the world in many ways. And they have brought that, people like Victoria Nuland, seeking to roll back Russia as a means of moving history forward in a progressive way. That's, you know, it's a very dangerous ideology that you're going to move history forward in a progressive way. By the way, that also helps my, serves my cause. But these are the, I think, the profound ideological, philosophical differences here.
I think it's so much amazing how these people are so much the enemy of Russia today. And I don't know what's the perception on their part from Russia, because Russia in that region, in those, in that part of the world, they're not that much involved in any sort of, when it comes to the Middle East, they're trying to keep, because Russia is a big country. It's not just a small country. They have to, they have a lot to manage in Russia. And these people are, recently we had the Michael Clark, we had Michael Clark, the one of the experts on Sky News. He mentioned the only, the person responsible in the Biden administration for the policy in Ukraine was Antony Blinken. Even somehow Jake Sullivan were, was somehow going against him to moderate him, to somehow limit him in the terms of action he was doing. But we know that Antony Blinken came from Russia or Ukraine, what we know as Ukraine today. What is this sort of animosity that they have, they possess toward Russia? Where does it come from? Do we have any sort of understanding in that?
Yeah, as I just mentioned, this goes back to Russia and Jewish traditions. I mean, many of the leading Bolsheviks in the Russian Revolution were from Jewish background. We all know the Jews have a very rich tradition of social criticism, feeling the need for social change, which benefits the public. It's, it can be very positive, humanistic vision. But also Jews historically in Russian Empire suffered a great deal from kind of an oppression. Jews played a very important role in the Russian state, I don't get me wrong. Scientists, writers, military people, all kinds of positions. But nonetheless, I think Jews felt that somewhat discriminated against, and Eastern Europe has been even worse in its long-term discrimination, especially countries like Poland have long, long traditions of anti-Semitism. So I think people coming out of that Jewish tradition have legitimate reason to look back with anger and hostility to some of what Russian society stood for in the past. And even today, what other countries in the region might do. So, you know, it's, there is an explanation of understanding of Israel, and I'm sorry, an understanding of Russia as to why they are somewhat hostile to it. Ironically, as we know, the Ukrainian government and in its military has lots of rather more neo-Nazi types of people who are very anti-Semitic. And of course, Zelensky himself is Jewish, so I'm not sure that he's beloved by his more neo-Nazi military, but the fact is they need his political skills to help keep this war of national defense, Ukrainian national defense, to keep that going. But I don't see that there's going to be any big change in this. And Blinken himself was, as you said, was not only of Russian origin, but Russian Jewish origin. And that explains a lot, including a natural fear and anxiety and bad memories of what Russian society meant for Jews. I mean, there was no Holocaust in Russia, but they were Jews often found difficulties in maneuvering Russian society.
Graham, when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, we know that Donald Trump, I know that you are somehow like me, we are optimistic about Donald Trump and the way that he's somehow trying to do something with the foreign policy of the United States. When it comes to Iran, to Russia, somehow China. But he said in two times he posted on his social, on his page in Social Truth, he mentioned that Russia, the president of Russia is absolutely crazy. He wants all of Ukraine. I always know that. And he plays with fire. What is it when it comes to Donald Trump? Is somehow he's trying to put pressure? It's somehow it is a bargaining process in his mind, in your opinion?
Yes, that's exactly right, Nima. I think Trump is the classic bargainer. He views everything as a transaction of some kind or other. I think he likes to pretend to be angry at one moment and put his opponents on their back feet and uncertain as to where to go. Then he changes his mind. You can't be certain that anything Trump says as of any one given moment represents the full story. It's the full story right now for you for today. But I might change my mind tomorrow, and I might hug you, and I might like you. So let's not be enemies, but I'm reminding you that I'm putting pressure on you. I think Russia understands. I think Putin in particular, and Lavrov, I would have to say, and maybe people will hate me for saying this, but I think Putin and Lavrov are probably the two most intelligent and sane foreign policy figures in the entire world. Very experienced, very careful, very cautious, very balanced, but nonetheless, they know where they're going. We don't have to agree with that, but they're very, very cautious. So I think they well understand when Trump makes some remark about Russia or some insult or I'm fed up with Russia, or I'm very disappointed with Russia or whatever. That's today. Wait till tomorrow. It might be different there then. And they, as a result, don't seize on him and attack him for that one remark. They take this as part of a longer process. Another president you might treat differently, but Putin and Lavrov really understand who Trump is, and I think how best to handle him if they can for better results.
Graham, when I look at, when I want to find who, for example, which country is so much important for Brazil, I look at the ambassadors of Brazil in those countries to see which countries much more important for Brazil. When we look at Ukraine and compare the ambassador of Ukraine to the United States with that one to the United Kingdom, you see the difference. Zelensky is, nobody's even comparable with Zelensky and the position he had before going to the United Kingdom. And we know that recently when there was a talk between the two parties, Russians and Ukrainians in Istanbul, Zelensky went to Istanbul. Right after, when he went to Istanbul, British government sent someone to be with him in Istanbul. How can you understand what is this role, this somehow hidden role of the British government in Ukraine, and nobody can seize that? Because recently there was an interview on Sky News, conservative leader Kemi Badenoch. She said that the two wars in Ukraine and in the Middle East are proxy wars on the part of the United Kingdom. Who are these people that they're feeling that these are two proxy wars on their part, and how, why is that somehow delusional on their part, or they're just saying it the way it is, that we are not that much aware of the reality?
It's important to look at history, Nima, in this regard as to the incredible history of the British Empire. I mean, one of the longest run empires and one of the biggest empires in the world. I think its only rival was the Ottoman Empire, perhaps. I don't know exactly. But Britain has never recovered from losing its empire. They were always number one all over the world. The slogan was that the sun never sets on the British Empire. It's everywhere all the time. And the number, they didn't use these words perhaps, but number one in the whole world. So the collapse of the UK after the pressures of World War II was a terrible blow. I don't think UK has ever fully recovered, but in this regard, they seized on the close alliance and friendship with the United States to as a kind of leverage for their own power. I think they used the term that between British brains and intelligence and American brawn and strength, this is an unbeatable combination, and America will tell Britain will tell America where to go and what to do and what wars to fight and how to use its military strength to perpetuate even UK British goals. So that's a very important background to this whole thing. I think the British still feel very much left out of it. I think they have deep imperial instincts in them more than perhaps any other country in Europe. And frankly, at this point, we've talked about this before, but I think Europe as a whole is absolutely without leadership or vision or direction or even sense of identity as to who they are, where they are, and what they want to be in the future. I think they thought maybe, okay, we're part of the great American empire, and yes, we're honorary number one people within that empire, but that hasn't been working out as well. And now that Trump seems like it might even abandon the NATO in this war in Ukraine, Europeans are absolutely horrified. Who are the Europeans at this point? What are their interests? What are EU interests? What are their own interests? Surely they're not necessarily the interests of America in going to war in Syria or going to war against Iran or going to war in Iraq or going to war in Afghanistan, which America always wanted Europe to contribute to and be part of. I think finally maybe the Europeans are beginning to think, wait a minute, do we really want to do this? Do we want to join in every American war? Is that in our interest? And now you find the rise of China, in particular with the United States saying, now Europe, don't you deal with China because it's a very dangerous country and we have to stick together. I think EU is beginning to wonder, do we want to ignore China? Should we put China at arm's length? Do we want to be hostile with China? I think this whole business of the emergence of the BRICS is a really shocking event. Here are all these brown people and swarthy people from all of these countries around the world who are now suddenly beginning to emerge with a powerful economy and a new voice in the world. And if you look at the map, where is Europe? It's just this tiny little tail end of Eurasia. Is that what Europe is now? Is that where they're going to sit? Will they want to sign up as part of greater Eurasia? That might make some sense. But you can see now the struggle for Europe to say, oh my God, who are we? Where are we going? What's happening to us? What do we do now? And the leadership is terrible and not even fully democratic in the sense that nobody appointed von der Leyen, nobody appointed half of these people. And Germany right now, as I think, is moving in exceptionally dangerous direction.
Can we say that the the United Kingdom is in charge in Europe, or you consider somehow some sort of role for, because Graham, when it comes, it's not just about, I talk with Iranians, they point at, you know, at the United Kingdom. I talk with Russians, they point at the United Kingdom. And Zelensky, we know that he's so much connected with the British intelligence, not with American intelligence. And they have everything. They have somehow the total control of the Zelensky administration. And somehow, when we look at the talks on the part of the Biden administration, you see how British were so much connected with Ukraine and somehow mediator between Ukraine and the United States, even under the Biden administration. Because these are not something so small, something tiny that you cannot consider. These are huge issues. The war in Ukraine is not a tiny little issue for Russia. And
yeah, I agree. I don't know exactly the degree of British strength, but it's obviously very powerful, and they have greater interests, if you will, in some ways, because they have, the British Empire has been at war with the Russian Empire for several hundred years, as you know. And historically speaking, Imperial London was terrified that the Russian Empire would come down over through Central Asia and invade through the Himalayas and invade and take over India, take over British India. This goes way, way back. It's deep in the British psyche, this fear somehow of Russia that is deeper than even in the US. But I can't fully explain it all. I think it's a losing game for them. I don't know whether I think there may be some differences between Britain and the rest of the EU, but I don't know how serious those are anymore. They're still having to figure out where they are going to go. And how much more war do they want? And if America is not involved in that war, is the EU capable of a war on its own? Everyone says no, it's not. But so far, I think there seems to be a rise in especially German public opinion in hostility to this kind of policy. But so far, until new elections come yet again in Germany, this rather, I don't know what I'd call a neo-imperial or revanchist policies of Germany against Russia are still very, very much there. And it's dangerous. I have great admiration for Germany as a culture, historically, et cetera. But I think many Europeans get nervous when now the new Prime Minister Merz talks about Germany now becoming the number one military power in Europe. That, you know, it brings back some bad memories. What does that mean? Hopefully nothing bad, but you never know. And it's a time of tremendous ideological crisis and crisis of identity in Europe as a whole. And I don't know where this is heading, but Trump is speeding up this crisis for better or for worse.
I think that's why the United States needs to consider needs to talk with Russia in terms of the security architecture of Europe, because that would bring all of these insanity to an end, in my opinion.
You're absolutely right, Nima. I fully agree.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Graham, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Well, thank you, Nima. These are fascinating issues that make us all have to think very carefully about it all. So I look forward to next time at some point. Good.
Yeah. Khoda hafiz. Bye-bye. Khoda hafiz.